All right, everybody. BioBros, episode 5 on all streaming platforms. This one is our Thanksgiving special with a bit of a twist. We're not doing a full Thanksgiving special. This is going to be about genetics and line breeding, mostly line breeding and a touch on Mendelian genetics. But the examples we're going to be using are about Thanksgiving and how the foods we eat at Thanksgiving don't actually exist. And we'll get into that in 1 second. So, Alex, what are the top two of the foods that you would think of for Thanksgiving?
Obviously, turkey.
Turkey, number one.
It's the main thing.
And then, corn, right? Yeah, cornbread, cornucopia. I know it's not actually made of corn, but you get the point. Both of those are not real. So, we'll start off with corn and why corn is not real. So corn, about 7,000 years ago, there was a wild grass in central Mexico called teosinte. Teosinte. I don't know. It's a hard one. I can't pronounce that for some reason. And it was like little small kernels that weren't like close together, like how we think of corn. And the native people of that region started farming it, and then they started like picking the ones that had the biggest kernels on there and the most of them. And they just kept doing that for thousands of years. And then it turned into the corn we know. And corn now is so different than it was back then that corn cannot survive without human intervention. It needs people to care for it, or it just does not live, which is super cool. And another quick little interesting fact about this one is Europeans, when they came to America for the first time, the whole pilgrims, Christopher Columbus, all that stuff you learned about at school, when they first came, actually one of the bigger impacts they had was bringing corn back to Europe. Corn did not exist in Europe at all until those European voyages over to the Americas happened. So, kind of interesting there.
Yeah, and I guess I'll do turkeys. So, like, a game turkey, like a wild turkey that you see in your yards or running through the woods or the streets and things like that, they are so genetically different than the turkey you eat at a, like, Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever. Because the turkey that you eat, They're genetically made to be bigger, heavier, have more meat on them. They don't fly. They don't run. If they were thrown out in the woods, they would die almost instantly. They're also almost always white feathered and things like that. Versus a wild turkey, they taste completely different. They're lean. There's not as much meat on their body. They're a lot gamier because they're eating those wild nuts, grasses, and berries, everything else they can get their hands on. They fly all over the place. They fly up to the trees to roost every single night and fly down every morning. And they're running from predators, running from people, all that kinds of stuff. So they're a completely different animal genetically versus the animal that you were eating for Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah, and I did a little research on the history of this one, too. And we actually domesticated turkeys twice, both in Americas. And one group, this took place about 2,000 years ago, roughly the same time, in New Mexico, Arizona kind of area. And they thought they were obtained from Mayan areas in like Guatemala and central Mexico. However, that's not true. So the southwestern turkeys were different, and the ones in central Mexico were different. So two groups of people in the Americas about 2,000 years ago decided we should start farming turkeys. And then that has kind of morphed together and been line bred and selected for the traits they want all the way up until now, to the point where people argue about the differences. Like, they'll be like, is this a wild turkey or is this a common turkey? It's just, it's very, very different. It is cool to look at, go look up some images of like wild turkeys versus like domestic turkeys. There's a very distinct difference. Everybody, you can tell very quickly, is very interesting. So two of the biggest things you eat at Thanksgiving are not real. They don't exist without farming. And it is kind of cool that actually both of those things did actually originate in the Americas too. That is actually a thing. Mm-hmm. The Europe did not have those until, I guess, Thanksgiving, you could say. I mean, that's approximation, but you guys get the point.
Yeah, it's very interesting that they found these new plants and new animals and stuff, and now they're a time-old tradition of eating them.
Yeah, and they're not even real. Corn is the one that really gets me, because it's so different. Like, if you look up pictures of, like, the parent plants of corn, it's completely irrecognizable. Turkeys make sense. Like, that's a pretty big bird. There's some meat on there to eat, but the corn, they decided this little terrible plant to eat was going to be good, and then they did actually turn it into a good plant.
Yeah. Genetics, it just shows you. Genetics are amazing.
Yeah, and that was before they even knew genetics were a real thing. They just kind of stumbled into it over the course of hundreds of years. But we'll get into genetics a little bit. So, genetic and how this kind of relates to pets and animals and stuff. There's two main kind of things that you're looking for. And we're going to simplify it a little bit too, because you can go down some serious rabbit holes. We did a little bit in the pre-show about like some very specific morphs. But there's line bred traits, and then there's Mendelian genetics. So line bred traits are like what happened with turkeys and corn, where they just slowly over time pick the biggest and strongest ones or the tastiest ones. And over time, they just kind of changed and developed. That's like polygenic traits or multiple genes are involved. It's nothing too crazy. Well, it's not like thought out. You can't do math and figure out what your percentages are really going to be. It's just kind of gradual over time. We're making these things look a little different. And then the Mendelian genetics are tracking the dominance of genes and the genotypes or the genetics of the parents to figure out what percentages and all that you're going to get of the babies. And not all things are Mendelian genetics, because like I said, that word polygenic means multiple genes are involved, and that can't really be Mendelian, because Mendelian follows one genetic. Just one gene, one thing at a time. So we'll do some examples. So Alex, I know your day geckos you keep have morphs that are for sale, but they're not Mendelian. So
no, you want to every get single into... one of them are a line bred trait. Essentially with day geckos, there's what they call blue bloods, super blues, crimsons, super crimsons, your normal day geckos, and patternless. And this is for Felsuma grandis, so the Madagascar giant day gecko, but it's specifically to Felsuma grandis. None of them are from actual Mendelian genetics. They are like a good example, because I actually have them, crimsons. So essentially what a crimson day gecko is, a day gecko that presents more red on its back, more red spots, more red lines, things like that. And essentially what they did was they found an animal that had more red, and they went, that looks really cool. And they would breed it, and every time they'd find one that had more red, they'd add it into the line and just keep going and going and going until they get these really red animals. Again, they're not, there's no percentages, there's no, oh, this is going to work, oh, we'll get this amount. No, it's just, we're getting more red because we're breeding the animals with the most red together to continue to try and get more red. Same thing with the blue bloods. That one's just the higher amounts of blue in the animal, they just bred animals with more and more blue until they got these mostly blue animals. Just taking the ones that have the most blue, breeding it into that line over and over again until you get the animals that have the most blue.
Yeah, it's line breeding is fairly, the process is fairly simple. It takes a long time. There is time and effort and stuff put into it. But it just kind of means we're slowly the biggest ones, the tastiest ones, the ones with the most of this color are getting bred more and more and more. And that happens all the time. Happens in bearded dragons and stuff. I know I'm going to use bearded dragons as examples a lot because I was going to be a bearded dragon breeder back in the day. So I know a lot about all those genes. A lot of them don't exist. Like tiger, if you hear somebody say you have a tiger, that means nothing. It doesn't mean nothing. It just means it has stripes. It's not genetic. It is genetic, but it's not necessarily going to pass down to its offspring. It just means that individual has stripes. So you'll hear like all kinds of different words like sunburst, this and that. No, it just means orange. It's just a line bred for more orange animal. And then there are Mendelian genetics. And these are, I like Mendelian genetics. They're fun. I'm pretty good at them. I got trained up pretty intensely when I was younger about how to do all the calculations and stuff in my head. But they're invented by this monk named Gregor Mendel. He studied pea plants and why pea plants don't look like their parents. And then he ended up discovering dominance. Later on, we learned about chromosomes and alleles and all that stuff. But he just kind of figured out that you get one gene from your mom, one gene from the dad, and they combine and then they make something. So dominance is the dominant gene. In people, brown hair is dominant. So if you have a brown hair gene, you will have brown hair. So I'll even use my parents as an example. Both of my dad's parents had blonde hair. So he has, and blonde is recessive. So he has to have two recessive genes in order to show the blonde hair. So all he can give to his kids is the blonde hair gene. That's it. He can have 100 kids, he's given them all blonde hair gene. And my mom is the exact opposite. My mom had two brown haired parents, and their parents were brown haired. It goes all the way back. My mom has double brown hair, which is dominant. So my mom could only give her kids brown hair, which means my genetics are one brown hair from my mom and one blonde hair from my dad. So I am heterozygous, or het, which means I have mixed genes from both of them. And it gives me the opportunity to potentially have a blonde haired kid, even though I'm brown haired. That's why every so often you'll see two people with brown hair have a blonde haired kid. They're like, where'd this come from? It's like, well, look at your parents. That gene was there. It was just hidden. That's kind of a lot. It's hard to show without diagrams and stuff on here. We don't have that accessibility yet. But those are super cool. Those are what we call like a true morph, because you can calculate things. You can read this to that, and you can anticipate what the babies are going to look like and based on what the parents are going to look like. And you can tell what the genetics of the parents are if you don't know based off of the babies. That stuff's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's really just all around really cool because of being able to, like you said, be like, oh, this parent has this morph, this parent has this morph. I know this one's recessive, this one's dominant, or this one's codominant, blah, blah, blah. And like, I know this many babies should be this morph. This many babies should be this morph. Especially when it gets to the more complex morphs, sometimes it gets to the point where it's like, this may say there's like, I guess, two morphs per parent or whatever, like albino and hypo one, and then the other ones,
But yeah, you're getting into that, like the dihybrid cross. I don't like that term because hybridization to me means that you're breeding together two separate species to create a hybrid of the two species, but they're just talking about hybrid alleles. Alleles is a specific gene. And That's all that means. And you get one from your dad, one from your mom. And yes. The dihybrid cross is pretty cool because then you can track how many you're going to get. You look at the Punnett squares, those, look that up. Look up a dihybrid Punnett square. It's a disaster. But they're kind of needed, unfortunately, much as I don't want it to be true. And you can track two separate genes in one creature. And you can see what the chances are that you're going to get this and that. And that's super neat. Like if both of your parents were hybrids or heterozygous for both of these traits I'm about to date, is then you could do that Punnett square and figure out what percentage of your kids were going to have the combo. So if both parents had brown hair and brown eyes, which are the dominant traits, but they were het for blue eyes and blonde hair, then you could do that whole square and see what the percentages are. Because there is a percentage, I believe it's 1/16th off the top of my head. Don't quote me on that one. Check my work on that. That's yes. Head math. That they will have a kid with blonde hair and blue eyes. And then there's a few other options in there. There's options for brown hair, blue eyes. There's options for brown hair, brown eyes. Options for all of everything in between is in there. It's super cool. It's a cool career too. It's not something I'm necessarily interested in like doing myself, but it is kind of fun. It's like genetic counseling. It's important for diseases and things. You can have potential, you can be a carrier for a disease and not display it yourself. And so you can go to a genetic testing person and they can tell two people if what the chances are that their kid's going to have illnesses or what they're most likely going to look like. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's very complicated very quickly with genetics, but it is very cool.
Oh, yeah, especially when you get into non-Mendelian genetics. They just don't quite work, and that's a headache. But the genetics cluster. Are, yeah, super interesting. And they've been on my mind a lot because I went to a reptile show, and everything there was morphs. And only a few of the morphs that were actually there were true like Mendelian morphs, and most of them were line bred. And then we were talking about episodes for Thanksgiving. I was like, that would be actually cool to show that, to talk about how Thanksgiving foods aren't actual real things. How we've been doing this genetic breeding and stuff before we even knew it was real. We only discovered DNA in the 1950s. Gregor Mendel was, let me make sure my dates are right here. The dude lived in the 1800s. Like, this stuff was done not long ago. Like, your great grandparents were like nearing that time that we even figured out that genetics were real. And we had already domesticated turkeys, completely changed them. Dogs, we completely changed. Cats, we changed, but not as dramatically. Corn, several kinds of plants we changed. We didn't even know what that was, and we were already doing this high-level stuff. Just recently did we figure out the why. Like, why we were able to do that, how it worked. And that's super cool to me. At that show, a large amount of stuff was morphs, and so many of them were line-bred, and that's not my thing, really. So I was really thinking about it and remembering back to my bearded dragon breeding days. It's like, we should talk about that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to be more and more in reptile shows and stuff that there is way more line bred animals than there are actual true Mendelian genetic morphs. The day geckos, all line bred. Majority of crested and gargoyles are all line bred.
Yeah, so, I believe there's only two like true genetic morphs on crested geckos, right, Alex? Yep. You had that.
Yeah,
those.
Yeah, guys. It was Lily Whites and Xanthix are the only true Mendelian genetic morphs.
Well, Lily Whites aren't even Mendelian. They're incomplete codominants, right?
Yeah,
and they're not even true dominant and true recessive. Which again, there is argument that true dominance and true recessive doesn't truly exist, but for the sake of argument, we're going to say it is. And I believe Xanthix is the only one that follows traditional Mendelian rules, I believe. And so there's only one Mendelian genetic morph. Not that codominance isn't real. Codominance is 100% real. It just plays by different rules. And that is more than I want to get into today. But yeah, so every time you see a crested gecko that's porthole, Dalmatian, Harlequin, this and that, it's just all line bred. Or it's just describing the animal is really what it means. It's just descriptors of Halloween means it's going to have a darker base and more orange, you know, highlights on it. It doesn't mean that it's any different, like anything special genetic wise that's going to guarantee pass on to its offspring. It's just describing how it looks, which there's no problem with. It's just interesting because people think of those as these like set in stone genetic morphs, and it's just descriptors.
Yeah, which was part of the reason I wanted to also do this episode, just like you had brought it up, and I was part of the reason I also wanted to do it, is because of so many people like get into the craze of like crested gecko breeding and things like that, and they're thinking, oh, if I breed this with this, I should get this. And in reality, they weren't going to get that because there aren't true genetic morphs or anything like that. And it made it to where people were spending thousands of dollars on all these geckos to then realize they wasted all their money to try and breed that specific gene.
Yeah. If you're a breeder, make sure you know those genetics.
Yeah, because like a lot of people also got lily whites and were breeding them together to try and get more lily whites. And those bred together actually, what is it? I think it's they.
Yeah, the babies end up killing out super, super, super weak. Forgetting the word off the top of my head. I have it in my biology notebook. I have it written down. But it's when genetics interact with each other. Sometimes two genes will interact and they will cause an illness. When they're on their own, they're fine. But if you get them from both parents, it causes other issues. And that's very not ideal. It happens with translucent bearded dragons. If you breed two translucent bearded dragons together, it will cause health issues. And so you have to be able to do your little Punnett square and make sure that they're not going to be matched up like that. You can only breed hets to hets and produce translucent like that. Or you can produce translucent to non-translucent and create hets. It's, you have to be careful because if they get too close, they will have issues. Some of that's due to inbreeding. Some of it's due to actual like genetics interacting in a funky way.
Yeah, it's just, you gotta know your genetics, know how what happens if you breed them together. Because there's other things too with certain genes, like the spider morph in ball pythons or the jaguar morph in carpet pythons. Both of those genetic morphs are linked to neurological problems. So people were breeding them together and they're cutting all these snakes that have neurological problems because it was attached to that genetic morph. It's just something happened when you bred those into things. They almost always had neurological problems, which is why, as a breeder, you have to be responsible and understand when you're breeding these two things together, if there's no known neurological things or, like, other diseases or being lacking the ability to live and things like that. By breeding these two things together, as a responsible breeder, you have to know and understand what you're doing, because that does happen. And if you continue to do it, you are not a responsible breeder.
Yeah. And as a buyer as well, it's something to be aware of. Even if you're not intending on breeding, you might have health issues with your animal if you buy a spider ball python. That's the most famous one of that. But yeah, it's very interesting. A gene that codes for, scale color and pattern also happens to interact in a bad way with the nervous system. So genetics are very weird. That's why we're sticking to Mendelian genetics, because they're the only ones that I know of that play by good rules. Incomplete dominance and codominant stuff will get you about 50% of the babies will have this no matter what. But man, it is very weird. It's very interesting and it's super cool too. Like, I morphs aren't for me. But more than anything, why morphs aren't for me is because of the inbreeding of them. A lot of them are created via unethical breeding rather than just luck and how it happens. So that's actually the main reason why I'm not into them. But it is really cool. Like, I understand why people are into it. Like, you're creating all these things and you're, it's really interesting and it is cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of in the same boat. Mine's more of like, instead of like all morphs not being really for me, mine's more of only true like morphs you could find in the wild, possibly very rarely, but it could happen, like natural morphs, so like hypo and albinos and things like that. Those are what I like mostly.
Yeah, and the ones that aren't too crazy, like they weren't necessarily created due to inbreeding.
No,
like,
yeah,
a lot of ball python morphs are created but due to irresponsible breeders. And even just ignorant breeders, there's so many different ball pythons out there that it is a tall task to be able to make sure that all of these are going to interact nicely. That is a thing.
And different morphs in that one animal, which is insane.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. I even saw that with hognose snakes nowadays. It's starting to be like that. There's a lot of Mendelian genetics in hognoses. And so you'll see things that are like quadruple heads. So the animal looks normal and is a carrier for like four different genes.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty wild. It really, like, that stuff's so cool, and that you can look totally normal and just be a carrier for all sorts of things. And it's scary too. Like, you can be a carrier for like sickle cell disease and not even know it. So you can be totally healthy and then your kid shows up and has a disease and you're like, where did that even come from? That's that genetic counseling career I was talking about. Like, that's actually kind of important to go to, like, make sure that you are going to be able to have, or just at least understand what your potential, what you could be potentially passing on to your kids.
Yeah.
So that's what's like colorblindness too. Colorblindness is a sex-linked genetic a gene. Mm-hmm. So it attaches to the X chromosome, and that's why, and it is recessive. But men only have one X chromosome. So if that has colorblindness attached to it, you will always have colorblindness. But since women have two X chromosomes on them, they have a chance to get bailed out and just be a carrier and be able to see normally.
Yeah, it's more likely for a man to have colorblindness than it is a woman because of that exact reason.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. Genetics are, you could talk about genetics all day.
Oh, yeah.
But we just kind of want to do this episode here, a quick little introduction to like line breeding and genetics and how it affects like your daily life. Like, your dog does not exist, right? Your dog is a wolf that was line bred to look a specific way, mm-hmm, or behave a specific way. The betta fish we talked about last week are mostly line bred for all sorts of different traits. Thanksgiving, like you're saying, isn't real, right? The foods we eat at Thanksgiving are all farmed and created, man-made. And that's another, we'll touch on this point because it's slightly controversial here. People talk about genetically modified foods all the time, right? They want non-GMO. Mm-hmm. But I understand the process that they're intending on talking to is putting like spider genes in a goat that is a real thing that they actually did.
Yeah.
And I understand that's what people are talking about. But I think it's funny when they buy like non-GMO corn. And it's like, yeah, it's... wait, for 7,000 years, we've been genetically modifying corn.
Well, the funny thing is almost everything in the supermarket is genetically modified at one point or another in history.
Yeah. The two examples we happen to use for Thanksgiving, because it's yesterday, if you're watching this video and are in America, as when it comes out, is, like, they're all genetically modified. There's a famous painting of a watermelon that was done in like the 1500s, I believe. And it looks completely different. And people are like, don't realize that that's actually a fairly realistic representation of what a watermelon looked like back then. But we bred more of them to have less seeds and more of the good part. Just over time, we just selected the tastiest watermelons and grew those seeds instead of growing the bad watermelons. So pretty much everything we eat has been genetically modified since we developed agriculture, what, like 10,000 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun, too. That's a good one. I know we're a little late, but bring that one up to your conspiracy theorist family members. Tell them everything you're eating is genetically modified. They'll lose it. Don't really
we do not recommend you actually do that.
Yeah.
Don't go start fights.
Don't start fights with your families, guys. It's just funny.
Yeah.
It's just funny that it is true. Like, that is a real thing. We are, everything's genetically modified, but I understand, guys, the process that people don't like. And yeah, I get the fear behind it. It is reasonable to be wary of new technologies. That's fine. You're not insane for that.
No.
You might be wrong. You might be right. I don't know. Who's to say? It's brand new.
Only time can tell.
Yeah. All right, guys. It's going to be a quicker episode today because I just want to do kind of intros. Remember, line breeding is just breeding over years and years and years for a specific trait. And then, like, Mendelian genetics are much more predictable, and you can predict and graph out how they're going to carry on to the offspring. Very quick explanations of that. When we get video qualities on here, I want to redo this episode where I can draw diagrams. So much easier with diagrams. But look it up. Look into this stuff. Like, I hope this episode gets you just interested in how to look in genetics and you do more research on it, because it's really cool. Like, it is something that I do have a lot of interest in.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very interesting. Genetics in general just are. We've not even scratched the surface getting into them, but hope y'all enjoyed this episode. We are hoping to start posting more on YouTube as well as Instagram. We're going to start posting reels on Instagram and shorts on YouTube that we've been posting on TikTok. So if you want to see that kind of stuff, subscribe, follow us, give us likes, give us a rating on Spotify, YouTube, all that kind of stuff. All the links will be down in the description. If you want to join our Discord, so telling us episodes you'd like to see, or just talking to us, showing us your plants, showing us your animals, enclosure builds, all that kind of stuff, or even your artwork and stuff. All that stuff will be down in the description, all the links to everything, all the other social media, and also to Shaw and I's personal social media. But yeah, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and happy belated Thanksgiving to our American listeners.
And if you guys made it this far, leave a comment of how you found us. I want to know.
Yeah.
Especially if you made it this far into the show, let me know. I am interested in that one. But yeah, happy Thanksgiving, guys. Hope you guys get some good Black Friday deals if you're listening to this the day it comes out. Get on it. There are some good ones out there. And we'll see you guys next week.
See you next week.